So tonight I'm going to talk about the major arcana of the tarot and how it portrays a path of spiritual growth. And I know that not everyone is familiar with the tarot, so I'll give a very brief introduction to the tarot before I begin. The tarot, it has roots in the Middle Ages, perhaps earlier. It incorporates lots of mystical traditions. So the tarot as we know it is 78 cards. And 56 of those cards, they fall in four suits. So suits of 14 cards each, ace through 10 plus court cards. Very, very similar to our modern playing cards. And in fact, there are some people that think the modern playing cards evolved out of these. The suits are cups, wands, swords, and pentacles. And those are associated with the four Greek elements. They're also associated with the four psychological functions, thinking, feeling, intuition, sensation, not necessarily in this order. Those collectively are called the minor arcana. And then the other 22 cards is this series of archetypal images, and I'm going to be discussing these cards tonight, and these are called the major arcana. And in a typical reading, major and minor arcana cards are just shuffled together. In a typical tarot reading, if minor arcana cards are coming up, that's more indicative of, say, a person's personal stuff, whereas major arcana is, you might say, more archetypal images or issues arising from the collective unconscious. The deck that we're going to be looking at is called the Rider-Waite deck, which is a little over 100 years old. It has this name because Rider was just the company that published it. Arthur Waite was the actual scholar, the professor, the occultist who provided a lot of the wisdom, and he redesigned the cards. And then this remarkable woman, Pamela Smith, she was actually the artist who drew the cards. And in fact, many of the images are co-collaborations between Waite and Smith. And the magic of this deck is that the deep wisdom is in the picture. It's all encoded visually in the picture. And so that's quite extraordinary about these cards. So the major arcana. The first card is the Fool. So this is, you might say, the beginning of the hero journey. And it's quite apt because when we're at the beginning of a hero journey, we usually don't feel like a hero. We usually feel like a fool. And I will say also that the Fool, really, in the Middle Ages, the Fool represented not someone who was stupid, but someone who was inexperienced, who didn't have knowledge because they hadn't been exposed to it yet, you know. And so there's an element of, you might say, purity or even innocence to the Fool. And of course, the Fool is, you know, it's his golden skies. Everything is very optimistic in the Fool's world. And he's about to walk off the edge of a cliff and the little dog is barking, you know, the way that intellect, you know, tells us always, if intellect had our way, we'd never go on this journey, basically. The intellect would come up with thousands of reasons why we shouldn't undertake the hero's journey. And so there's a wonderful innocence to the Fool as he's about to plunge into the abyss. In the first significant card after the first card after the Fool is the Magician. And you might say this is the archetype of the wise old man. This is what Merlin was to King Arthur. This is what Obi-Wan Kenobi was to Luke Skywalker. The Magician is that very wise part of us. And this is an image just of tremendous, first of all, tremendous life-giving wisdom. You know, he's holding his hands up and down, pointing both to the sky and to the earth. There's flowers in bloom everywhere. This is the wisdom that nurtures life itself. I'll also say this is the only card in the entire deck in which all four of the suit attributes appear at once. He's on the table in front of him is a wand, a sword, a cup, and a pentacle. And so in many ways, the Magician, you might say, is the lord of the entire tarot deck. Sometimes our hero journey begins because we hear something wise, we have an encounter with a wise person, we read something in a book that opens a perspective for us. Sometimes it's just an intuition, a dream, or a sense that arises in our own life. It, you might say an insight that bubbles up from within, bubbles up from a place of wholeness about, there's a thread here and I need to follow it. And so the magician is about that insight that starts the journey. And then the next four cards, I'll call them parental cards, various kinds of parental figures. And it's funny, psychoanalysis usually begins with, tell me about your mother, this sort of thing. So many of our foundational issues go back to our family of origin. And so the first of these parental images is the High Priestess. And you might say this is an aspect of the feminine that is dark and mysterious. You notice how her gown is turning into water. She has a crescent moon at her feet. There's actually a dark ocean behind the curtain. The B and the J stand for Boaz and Yachim. These are the names of the pillars of Solomon. This is actually, believe it or not, this is actually straight out of the Bible. In the book of Kings, when Solomon built his temple, they said that the first two pillars, they should be named Boaz and Yachim. And so that's where the B and the J come from. But whereas, Solomon's temple was an actual, real temple, the temple behind her is this dark ocean, pointing to the mystical knowledge that she holds. And she's holding a scroll that says Torah, some kind of law or some kind of mystical law that she's half holding. And this is an aspect of the feminine that is really untamable, that is really dark, mysterious, and uncontrollable, giving rise to intuition, knowledge through dreams, this sort of thing. And of course, all the aspects of masculine and feminine we have in all of us. But this is a very fear-inspiring kind of aspect of the feminine. There are pomegranates on the curtain behind her that calls to mind the Greek figure of Persephone, and there's a lot of Persephone energy in the High Priestess. Now, contrast with her, the Empress. The Empress is the warm, fuzzy kind of femininity. The Empress is the warm love of the mother that allows you to love yourself. It is the nurturing mother. An incredibly warm, nurturing, caring, gentle kind of place, and tremendously life-affirming as well. And again, all of these are places that exist within all of us. Even if our real mother does not fit this description, this is a place within all of us that we can access. The first of the father images is the emperor. And you'll notice he has this kind of man's man sort of quality to him. He's wearing the armor under his royal robes. There's tremendous strength, solidity to him, stability, tremendous groundedness and power that comes from groundedness. This ability to use force if he needs to use force, and a tremendous respect also. Kind of he gains respect by showing respect. All of this is contained in the emperor. And again, this is a very powerful, grounded, masculine place that is within all of us. A very earthy sort of masculine place. And contrast that with the Hierophant, a much more spiritual masculine place, very much associated with clarity, with the broad vision, with the high kind of the universal spiritual truths. In contrast to the High Priestess, which is about esoteric knowledge, you might say this is the more articulatable knowledge of the world's traditions, the great ideals that we could actually articulate from any religion. And so tremendous power in this figure also. So after the four parental figures, we get the lovers. And you might say this card is about the excitement of new beginnings, you know, and certainly new relationships have that excitement. But, you know, sometimes starting a new job, people start a new job with excitement. You know, sometimes the spiritual path, people, there's a stage on the spiritual path when people are starting and they're really excited about the spiritual path. You know, I remember my first week when I was, you know, just began meditating. I just had taken the vow, I'm going to meditate every day. And the first week I was so excited, you know, this is great. I'm going to turn into Gandhi, you know. And it's wonderful. It's something that it doesn't last forever, but it's fine. There's a magic to it, that magic of new beginnings. So there's kind of an Adam, you know, it's really Adam and Eve that we see, but already behind Eve, we see the tree with the snake and the apple. So you know that, you know, it's not going to be paradise for long. And immediately after the lover, we get the chariot. And this is, you might say, if the first one was dating, this might be more marriage. This is about holding things together and more about the discipline of continuing. Very easy to fall into excitement, to fall into love, to get excited at the beginning. Harder to continue with perseverance. And this is about continuing with perseverance. Of course, one of the images that's called to mind by the chariot is, of course, the Bhagavad Gita. The entire Bhagavad Gita, in fact, takes place within a war chariot. It takes place because the warrior Arjuna falls into despair, and his charioteer happens to be Krishna, who sings the song of God to him. And so all those themes of the Bhagavad Gita, the non-attachment to the result of action, selfless service, the liberation through action in the world, all of that is contained in the ideas of the chariot. And of course, the two beings who were lovers are now sphinxes pulling the chariot. After we learn to persevere, then we start to learn the moral lessons. And so there are four moral lessons, or four or five, depending on how you count. And the first of these is strength. And this is a very peculiar kind of strength portrayed here. This is not domination by any means. It's not that kind of strength. She's taming the lion through gentleness. The lion is licking her hand. The lion is completely obedient to her. And so she has control over the lion through this gentleness. And that's a very particular kind of strength, establishing control through compassion, kindness, gentleness. Ultimately, this is the kind of a strength the kind of relationship we're called to have with our own bodies, you know, not coercing my body to be a certain way, but through loving and accepting my body, as it were, taming the power of my body and gaining the affection of my body so that my body and my mind are in a very powerful synchronization. And there's a tremendous strength in that. Next is the hermit, which you know, you in some ways has a very obvious meaning of comfort in being alone, you know, and it's part of the spiritual path. It's not that we always have to be alone, but can I be alone? Can I go within and just be by myself, you know? And the hermit is that place where we're just able to drop all the unhealthy connections we have to others, all the codependent stuff, all the caretaking, you know, can I leave all that behind and just be with my own self, you know? And it's actually, once I'm able to master that, of course, it's much more powerful than to go out into the world from that place of being comfortable with myself. Now, this one, it's hard to, whether we consider this a moral lesson or it's kind of the centerpiece of the other four moral skills. The Wheel of Fortune. The Wheel of Fortune was a very potent symbol in the Middle Ages. And it's in many ways, it is the centerpiece of a worldview, of a countercultural worldview, a worldview that was running counter to the prevailing medieval church and the church's ideology. You know, the church's ideology was one essentially that, you know, God is good and God controls the world and God rewards good people and punishes bad people. And so good things happen to good people and bad things only happen to bad people. You know, that was sort of the basic, you know, party line of what the church was saying. And the Wheel of Fortune was a very different worldview. The Wheel of Fortune was, you know, it's by random, you know. You look at the world, you see good people getting nailed all the time. You see bad people prospering, you know. It's completely random who suffers and who's rewarded. And so it was a powerfully different worldview to the Christian worldview, and one that actually has had profound influence on our modern world. Here we see in this image, you know, first of all, the yellow figures around the outside are the symbols of the four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're animal symbols. On the wheel itself, we have, if you go around one way, if you go around clockwise, you get tarot. If you go around counterclockwise, you know, the way that you'd read right to left in Hebrew, you'd get Torah, so Torah or tarot. In between the letters are Hebrew letters, the letters of the so-called tetragrammaton, or the unpronounceable name of God, the YHWH name, you know, God's personal name in the Bible. And of course, there's a Sphinx just sitting magically on top of the wheel. You know, the idea is the king tries to get up to the wheel, but as soon as he gets up to the wheel keeps turning and the king is thrown off the side. You know, so only a magical being like this, like the Sphinx, can actually sit at the top of the wheel. And you might say the deeper message of the Wheel of Fortune is, don't try to go up to the top. You know, if you go to the top, you're going to be thrown to the bottom. Go to the center. Try and remain at the center. The center is the one still place in this diagram, the one place where you can find peace. What T.S. Eliot calls the still point of the turning world. And then a very classical image of justice. Sometimes justice is portrayed as blind. This lady's definitely not blind. And this is a very powerful lesson and a hard lesson. You know, at some level, it's fairness. And of course, you know, we all agree, you know, people should be fair. You know, it's a very practical lesson that we learn in grade school in many ways. But it's a deep lesson in the sense that, you know, how to say, if I have empathy, then certainly I feel bad when I hear that when something bad happens to somebody else, okay? But do I feel as bad as when it happens to me? You know, am I a person of such justice that I can look at my own sorrow and somebody else's sorrow equally? You know, that's a really, really hard question, you know? And it's, you know, justice and fairness are lovely concepts to banter about, but when it actually comes to my own skin, it's a very hard virtue to live up to. Then the nature of the game changes after justice. We get the hanged man. And this is about disorientation. This, you might say, is about the world being flipped upside down. There's a part of the, you know, at a certain part of the path, we're just learning skills and we're going along. But then there's a certain point where suddenly there's this shift. We cross this point of no return. And suddenly the things that I used to value, I don't value as much anymore. And suddenly the things that used to seem like priorities don't seem like priorities anymore. And the hanged man represents all this, the disorientation that comes at a certain point in the spiritual path. The hanged man calls to mind the symbol of Odin. Odin actually hung himself on the world tree, so he voluntarily hung himself. And it's said that Odin, for 9 days and 9 nights, hung on the world tree. Odin sacrificed to Odin. And on the 9th day, he was able to read the mystic runes. And reading the mystic runes was what it gave him the power to be king of the gods. And so there's a voluntary aspect to the hanged man. Sometimes we get to this place through a very voluntary way. Sometimes it's completely involuntary. Suddenly the world is flipped upside down, you know, and we're in the midst of it. And this, you might say, the hanged man is, you know, whether he realizes it or not, this is the journey down to the dark part of the path. And the next one is death. And so this is a powerful lesson, and it's not only physical death, it's more importantly the death of ego that can happen, the death of a worldview. There's death of a certain part of my personality that happens as, on part of the spiritual journey, you know. And what is our relation to death? What is our relation to loss? You know, this, the card represents the figure of death approaching. The king is already gone, you know, he's toppled, his crown is on the ground. The bishop is begging, you know, he's thrown down his crook and he's begging for mercy. I love the young woman in white. She's turning her face away, can't even look at it, can't even acknowledge it, you know. But the little child is offering a flower to death, you know. And can we approach loss with that kind of pure innocence and with that kind of beginner's mind? After death, we actually get the last of the moral lessons, temperance. And it might seem like this is out of place. It should have been with the others. Temperance is very deep. Temperance is about balancing appetites. And it's actually no accident that it follows death, because it takes a tremendous loss of ego, tremendous sacrifice of ego to really balance the appetites, you know, to eat only what I need and no more, you know, to stop at enough, you know, enough food, enough attention, you know, all the ways that I might stop at enough. And so this incorporates you might say the wisdom of limitation, the wisdom of emotional thrift or emotional frugality. You know, all this is contained in temperance. So some very deep wisdom of self-denying here. Then we come to the devil. The devil is about attachment. You want to know why Buddhism has such a problem with attachment? This is what attachment looks like, right here. And so we have the couple that was the young lovers. Now they're chained to the throne of the devil. This is the darkness that we most don't want to face. This is the, how can I say, there are the attachments that we're aware of, that we can articulate. And then there are the attachments that are so deep, we don't even know we're attached, until that attachment is challenged. And when those attachments are challenged, oh my God, that can be painful. And so the devil is about all of that, that deep visceral level, we didn't even realize how attached we were, that kind of thing. And just when you thought that it couldn't get any worse, the next card is the Tower. This is one of the most potent cards in the entire tarot deck. There's a lightning bolt striking this high, narrow tower, and people are thrown, they're knocked out of the tower, and they're thrown out into the void surrounding and plunging into the void. The Tower is about imprisonment. It's about all the ways that we imprison ourselves, all the ways that I didn't realize I was confining myself in this incredibly narrow way of this incredibly narrow sense of how I'm going to live or how I'm going to understand myself. And the Tower is this cataclysmic shattering of that inner prison. You know, and how can I say shattering of a prison that ostensibly sounds good, you know? It's really paradoxical. You know, there are actually cases of people who have been in prison for decades, and then then when they come out, when they're allowed to go out, they're actually frightened to leave because the prison has gotten familiar. And freedom, walking outside of the prison, is actually terrifying to them. And in many ways, that is precisely the situation of the parts of us that have been imprisoned for years. I will say the first time you go through the spiritual journey, the tower can be a cataclysmic event in your life. Subsequent passes through the spiritual path, the tower becomes less of a melodramatic thing. So the tower, you might say, is a tremendous inner stripping away and a stripping down and a shedding of everything that is not essential. And that leads to the star. And the star is all about that inner sense of direction. And it's funny, we have to completely lose all the things that orient us in the outside world and experience that full disorientation before we're able to orient ourselves inwardly. And so the star is about having that sense of direction, that inner sense of purpose. And the woman is naked. It's showing that she's been stripped down to a very basic, vulnerable kind of form. She's pouring water both into the pond and to the land, also nourishing, the wisdom nourishing both the body as well as the deep emotional depths. There's a phoenix bird on the tree in the back, the phoenix which has just risen from the ashes. So there's a tremendous life-giving energy to this, even though it's still nighttime. And then the moon, which provides even more light than the star. So this is now about having a very clear path. And we see there's a very clear path heading out into the hills. And of course, the moon, there are dogs and jackals baying at the moon. There's a crayfish, there's all kinds of, dangerous things in the dark parts of the psyche. But there's also a clear way out now and a clear path, you might say, back to the land of day. And this leads to the sun. And the sun is the place where we've passed through the dark part and we're now back in the light of day. The sun, you'll notice it has these alternating straight and wavy rays. And so it's really about showing how it's integrated that knowledge of both light and dark. And of course, there are sunflowers. The child is on a horse, so it's this sense of sort of being reborn in the world and this sense of newness having passed through that dark place in ourselves. Number 20 is the judgment. And this, of course, calls to mind the Christian scene of the Last Judgment. The trumpet shall sound and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, this sort of thing. But this is really about the world becoming alive. First, we become more alive. And then when I am more alive, then when I start interacting with the world is more alive. I experience a more alive world because I'm more alive in myself. And so this card is very much about the coming to back to life of the dead world around me. In the Arthurian legends, the Fisher King was wounded, and when the Fisher King was wounded, his land became the wasteland. His land died. And when the fool found the grail, and the Fisher King was able to drink from the grail, he came back to life, and then it revitalized the land. And so all of us in that way, we are, as it were, kings or royal figures. And the world we see is alive or not alive, depending on the quality, the vitality that we bring. Which leads to the world. And this, you might say, is almost a quasi-enlightenment symbol, dancing in this free central place. Again, we get the four images of the four evangelists. She also is holding the wands that the magician was holding at the beginning. And so this is a tremendously spacious, peaceful, being centered, being one with everything. It's certainly a magical place. And of course, part of the paradoxes of it is we're very centered and open. And so this has a lot in common with the fool. And so once we're in the world, we're the fool again, and the whole cycle can begin over again. And so there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in just, you know, how can I say it? Seeing that this cycle is something that can repeat over and over in any one life, and certainly over and over, of course, the span of lifetimes. So I will share at this point the quote sheet. Zoom is a bit fussy here. So I put the quote sheet in the chat. The first quote is from the fourth Zen patriarch, Sansen. And this is actually from a longer piece by him called Verses on the Faith Mind. It's actually the first lines of that longer piece. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When like and dislike are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. This has a lot of resonates certainly with justice and with temperance. Rumi said, "Search, no matter what situation you're in, O thirsty one, search for water constantly. Finally, the time will come when you reach the spring." You know, and the real spring is within us, of course. Papa Walt said, "I exist as I am, that is enough, and if no other in the world be aware, I sit content, and if each and all be aware, I sit content." That's from Song of Myself. And just that incredible groundedness, which is something present both in the emperor as well as in the hermit. Chekhov said, "Don't forget either, you unhappy man, that voluntary confinement is a great deal harder to bear than compulsory." You know, and it's often a fascinating question. What are the ways that I imprison myself? You know, it's a very deep question. Khalil Gibran said, "Out of suffering have emerged the strongest souls. The most massive characters are seared with scars." C.S. Lewis said, "We were promised suffering. They were part of the program. We were even told, 'Blessed are they that mourn.' And I accept it. I've got nothing that I hadn't bargained for. Of course, it is different when things happen to oneself, not to others, in reality, not imagination." So true. Joseph Campbell says, "The cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek." Very simple. This amazing quote from Bruce Lee, "Not being tense, but ready. Not thinking, but not dreaming. Not being set, but flexible. Liberation from the uneasy sense of confinement. It is being wholly and quietly alive, aware and alert, ready for what may come next." So he's describing the ideal state of the warrior, who's totally relaxed and flexible, but ready to react, you know. But in some ways, it's also very much the Zen state of being relaxing into life, being totally present, relaxed, flexible, and ready for anything. Paulo Coelho says, "When we least expect it, life sets up a challenge to test our courage and willingness to change. At such a moment, there is no point in pretending that nothing has happened or in saying we are not ready. The challenge will not wait. Life does not look back. A week is more than enough time for us to decide whether or not to accept our destiny." Barbara Marcianek says, "Only in the shattering can the rebuilding occur." Marion Williamson says, the spiritual path is simply part of the journey of our living our lives. Everyone is on a spiritual path. Most people just don't know it. Stephen Redhead said, "You create within your own mind your own cages that confine you." And David White says, "The clear pinpoint star that appeared above Lanon, one you did not realize you were following." And that's the funny thing about a star. Once we finally see the star, we might realize, wow, I didn't realize it. I've been following this for a while and didn't even realize it. Deborah Moffat says, "Living a spiritual life may not be easy. It demands total authenticity. It brings you to dance to a unique song that only you can hear fully. Sometimes you dance alone because no others can hear the music." Steve Maraboli says, "Quite practically, you must learn to let go. Release the stress. You are never in control anyway." Yasmin Mogahed said, "Don't despair if your heart has been through a lot of trauma. Sometimes that's how beautiful hearts are remade. They are shattered first." Rayan Khan says, "Strength is about pulling yourself together even after you've been shattered into 1,000 pieces. Falling is merely the first movement we take before risking." Matteo Sol says, "As an empath, it's vital that you learn to hold space for your emotions, even the most painful ones. By anchoring your breath, you can learn how to witness the emotional energies of others within you without attaching yourself to these sensations." T. Scott McLeod said, "You'll bring yourself the suffering you need to bring yourself so that you may awaken." That's a very humbling one. Kilroy J. Olster said, "Undergoing personal change is a difficult but necessary process of maturing into the ultimate manifestation of a desirable self. True personal transformation requires a person honestly to assess their inner spirituality and to adopt a clear vision of who they want to be. An earnest person experiencing inner transformation of their values and belief is apt to feel conflicted, confused, and disoriented. Change of self is displacement, disarticulation, and loss of self. Alteration of our self-image results in disrupting, dislocating, and modifying a person's perspective of what is significant." Ulrich Ice simply says, "Disorienting change pleases no one, yet it builds self-made heroes." Roy Bennett says, "Time doesn't heal emotional pain. You need to learn how to let go." And similarly, Nicole Soban says, "Sometimes the hardest part isn't letting go, but rather learning to start over."